Okay, okay, let's get started then. I think what I'd like to talk about is variability from what I call candidate sources and what we might learn from them, and I'll throw out some questions and perhaps, you know, get some feedback. I mean, some of these things, many of these things are in progress. Some of the things that I'll talk about are things which I've sort of thought about since I've arrived and haven't had a lot of discussions with other people during my visit. I'll primarily concentrate on the microquasar 1915 plus 105 because this source exhibits a quite a diversity of variability. It exhibits a quite a wide range in luminosities. And so you have the possibility of examining the system over a wide range in accretion rates. No, we're not. Well, all we know is that if you look at the luminosity, we know the distance to the source, roughly about 12.5 kiloparsecs from the radio measurements. And if you assume it's isotropically emitting, the X-ray luminosity exceeds 10 to the 39 Earth per second. So that's it. So maybe. Okay. That's the only evidence, as far as I know. But there's no companion, as far as we can see. No orbital period modulations. So this only piece of information that would suggest that it's a massive compact object.
How hopeless is it to do infrared spectroscopy or something to actually find a companion?
Well, people have been doing infrared spectroscopy, Mirabel and his collaborators, also Steve Eikenberry, and I think when one has seen some evidence of some lines, but it's not obvious that lines are from some star or whether it's just reprocessed radiation off the disk.
So that's the fact.
I don't think, yeah, it would be nice. It should be, yeah.
There were some rumors it's a little greater.
I don't think that's held up. So, also, this source has been monitored quite a bit in X-rays. I think probably XTEs, probably have over 100 observations of this source. And at the same time, it's also been monitored in radio with the Green Bank interferometer. And not only does one see variability in X-ray, but one also sees variability in radio. So this may be very useful information in trying to understand the system. Okay. Let's just give some ideas of what the challenges are. And let's see. Oh. So here's an example of light curve from 1915. So these are three different light curves on three different days. So the vertical axis is flux in Crab units. This is from XTE. And the horizontal axis is time. Each tick mark is 2 minutes. And so you can see that the top panel exhibits quite a large range of variability, factor of 4 or 5 in intensity variation. And you notice that there are phases where there's a quite prolonged dip phase lasting about 20 minutes. This is repeatable, that if you continue to observe this source, it has been observed, you see the same feature. In particular, you see this spike in the middle. You not always see this spike. Here's an example on October 7th data, where you see a dip of reduced duration. Here it's only about 6 minutes. It's not obvious whether that spike should be associated with that one or not. In addition, one sees regular burst type behavior. This is not the only type of bird's behavior one sees. Yes?
I think that spike at the top.
You're talking about which? This one.
Yes.
This is a reproducible.
That recurs.
Yes. Yeah. So if you would follow this on the same day, actually if you follow on different days, on another day you see the same thing. And I may even have, if I can find it. Let's see. Here, for example, there's a dip. This is on September 9th, 1997. This was May 26th, 1996. So this is repeatable. So you do see that dip. I mean, sorry, you see this dip plus that spike in the middle. And if you actually do the model fitting to this spectrum, use a modified black body and a power law as a two-component fit, then the temperature, radii, photon indices can be inferred. And what you find is that during this dip, it appears the temperature of the black body component decreases, the radius of the disk increases, or meaning region increases.
That's the inner radius of the...
Well, I don't know whether you call it inner radius of the disk. I mean, but usually what one assumes is that there is a black body, a multicolored black body,
yes.
And then you'd say, okay, there's a certain inner temperature, inner radius of this. Okay, this assumes, of course, you have a steady state situation. It's possible, of course, there maybe there could be a disk even in smaller radius than that, but maybe M dot's lower, or it's got a corona on top of it. But so one has to be a little careful.
A question about the fit.
About the fit. That's what it is.
Right.
But in terms, what it means is another question.
Yeah.
Okay. And so here, so what you would see that during this phase that the radius would increase significantly from 40 to 120 kilometers. These are direct what you get out of XSPECT. These, of course, are really what you're measuring is not really the effective temperature, which is what you assume from a black body. These are really color temperatures. So really the effective temperatures are lower, and the actual radii, real radii, if you want to use this model, are actually larger, perhaps by a factor of 3. Okay, so you shouldn't take literally these numbers, but I think probably what you could believe is probably the trend.
Oh, excuse me, I lagged behind for a minute.
Yeah.
How do you measure the change in the radius?
So basically what you're doing is you at every so this is each tick mark is 100 seconds. So basically you're calculating spectra every 4 seconds.
Is this normalization of black hole?
So actually doing a fit.
So it's a black body fit to...
Plus a power law for a 4 second interval. So just a slice of data right here. You know, for 4 seconds, you accumulate data, you get a spectrum, then you fit that spectrum, and that's 1 point. So it's a huge amount of data analysis went into get this curve. Okay?
Because that fitting is, you can tell well enough the inner radius of the black body portion of
it? Well, it's a measure from a fit. I mean, it's not really unique.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think you could get some idea of how the changes are, what the changes are. I wouldn't believe literally the numbers. Okay, but I think the trend probably is all right. Also, what one notices that during this dip, you see the photon index becomes low, so spectrum becomes hard during this dip. And right at the spike, just about that spike, all of a sudden you see a significant jump, and the photon index becomes soft. So here's 3.6, so it's a rather soft spectrum. So right at that point, the spectrum of the source changes quite rapidly.
But those indices are, the entire range of indices corresponds to the soft state.
2.6 to 3.6, yes, not a... Yes, like 2 or 1 point. Yeah, that's right. But relatively speaking, for this source, it's rather soft. I guess it's soft compared to Cygnus X1 in its hard state. So there's a lot of information here, and there's a lot of questions that are raised by this observation. Also, on the bottom curve, is a dynamic power spectrum. So that's every 4 seconds you take a power spectrum. And then the power, great larger power, amount of power is indicated by darker points. So there's a frequency ranging from 1 to about 14 hertz in function of time. And so you see that during the, see one thing that the, these, you see the evidence of QPO present. And QPO is present primarily when the spectrum is hard. You don't see any evidence of the QPO when you have a soft spectrum. Okay, that's kind of an indication of other black hole candidate systems. When you see QPOs, it's always, the spectrum is always hard. Maybe not as hard as Cygnus X1, but always hard. You never see it when it's soft.
What about the 67 hertz?
Okay. Okay, 67 hertz is not seen during this time. Here, I should also mention that the frequency of the QPO is changing as a function of intensity. So these are intensity-dependent QPOs.
Is it the banana or something?
Banana.
I think there's very well stressing that it's very different from, say, top state of Cygnus X1, not only in the value of the index, but also in the soft gamma ray spectrum, that in that case there's never any high energy cutoff is detected. That gamma ray spectrum continues to run LED without cutoff.
Right.
While in Cygnus X1 we see thermal spectrum that cuts off about 100 kV.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, I looked at that Grove paper, and they only have a few dates in which they have observations, and they just provided a combined spectrum of the whole of the system up to about several hundred kilovolts.
But there were other,
and there was no.
The other paper sometimes.
I only looked at the Grove paper.
Your view really is not compatible with thermal compensation.
Absolutely.
So you need the non-thermal parts.
So this variation in Poisson spectral index is not due to the isotropic cooling.
Well, in the non-thermal case, you can also have some sort of feedback, but it's not so simple as in thermal. And it's very similar to the soft state of signal spectrum. The soft state of signal spectrum is very similar to the spectrum.
Really?
Yeah.
So wait, soft states of black hole candidates do not have thermal?
No.
Compensation?
No. They have no thermal compensation of what the
culture
flux does
not work. Yes.
But in the involved motion does not work because you get the high energy cutoff, which is not seen in the
data. That's great.
So the only, the best model is non thermal compensation.
That's only for systems where you can see energy out to photons out to several hundred keV, right? I mean, for bulk compensation.
A number of objects, and in all of them, there's no cutoff. So I mean.
Well, no cutoff to what energy though? To what energy?
200 at least.
But that's it's only if you go up to like 300 or 400 you see the cutoff. Then you could say his model breaks down, right?
No, in Cygnus X1, you see
the
potential already at
800.
50 kV or 100 kV the sloping down. And in those soft state objects, whenever you look, you see basically in the OC band the single power law limited by statistics. And you never see any cutoff. So there is a cutoff always at the
high. Yeah.
Right.
In other cases, it goes up to an MED.
Yeah, it goes up to an MED.
That's the claim. That's the charter. When you give the talk, it's extremely fascinating. I can't quite remember what the opinion is.
That's okay.
Well, it also does sort of weird things. OC has this so-called linear channel. So if you take OC data literally without revealing, you get just a mess about
right.
He shows that unpinched channel. And so look at it, there's no cutoff. But if you revealing it, you see, isotope to any growth, if he does that with ifolded power loss, then he gets the best, the lower limit of ifolded energy of 1 MeV or something like that.
Yes. So the people at Marshall also think that it goes on to an MeV too.
Yeah, so unless you really have spectra that go out above 100 kV, it's really difficult to, and you can still fit models with thermal compensation, it's just that above 100 kV, you really need to have the non-thermal part.
Yeah.
So for data where we only go up to, let's say, 100 kV, then people fit it with thermal compensation equally well. So it's,
yes,
it's kind of a degeneracy.
It's kind of,
yeah.
It's not compatible with
right.
the data.
Well, if you don't have the data larger.
Well, it's complete.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so let me go back to these QPOs, so try to learn something about these. So I said that the QPOs are present when the spectrum is hard and the frequency changes with intensity, and it seems that the frequency decreases and the radius, if we can talk about the inferred radius of the blackbody component, increases. What is there any further information you can get? Well, the answer is yes. This is the blackbody flux component as a function of a frequency. So you ask yourself the question, what I showed you in the previous picture was just photon counts. Now, if you actually do the fitting and you determine the relative contribution of the blackbody component to the power law component, what you find is that there seems to be some relationship between the soft blackbody component and the frequency, in the sense that when the soft component is greater, the frequency increases. So here you have a correlation where the frequency of the QPO seems to be associated with the black body of the soft disk component, but the QPO is only seen when the spectrum is relatively hard, with a photon index of around 2.6. Okay. What this suggests to me is that one is these oscillations are probably taking place in some kind of corona, so you have the hard spectrum. And they originate at perhaps the transition region between where the disk becomes optically thick, or maybe we have an ADAP, or at least it's a very extensive corona. And the so if the soft flux increases, so you could think of maybe that means the inner radius of that optically thick region moves in.
Okay.
So the frequency increases.
You want to draw the picture on the board. So
okay.
You can get your cards on the table.
Okay. I think I can find some chalk. Some chalk.
Chalk.
Yes, chalk. Yes, chalk. Green chalk, white chalk. So the picture that one has is, so, well, I don't know if you can see over there. So you have your compact object located here. You have some thick disk, geometrically thick disk here. You have some kind of corona, perhaps. You may have this disk move inside. I don't know. I mean, as I said, if it could be that the mass flow rate in this part of the geometrically thin disk may be different than the mass flow here, okay? But the picture that I have in mind is that if you move, if this transition region is moving, then if the oscillations are produced there or originate there, then the frequency of the oscillation will increase if this radius moves in, which is what you saw from the previous fit. And so the soft photon flux would reflect the energy emitted in this component.
Ron, do you actually see the QPO from the soft photon alone?
If you break up, these are stacked, okay? It's a little tough because you have to break up the energy bins. I mean, you're looking at things at 8 hertz, so it's only a tenth of a 2/10 of a second of oscillations, and you're breaking up into a whole spectrum. So it's a little tough. The only way you can really see is you can stack up spectra to pull it out. And this had to stack it up to actually see this. You don't see it direct in an individual FFT. at different energies.
In the sense that everyone, if you took up all the hard photons, you wouldn't lose an awful lot in terms of photon signal, and see whether or not you can still see it in the soft photon, because what you have emphasized is that you see the slightly different state, you see the QPO when the spectrum is hard.
That's right. When this photon index is relevant from.
More precise question than that. That would be very interesting.
Yeah. True. That's right. So the picture that one has is that if this is moving around, this transition region is moving around, then the contribution to the luminosity from the disk would change. And as this moves inward, it would increase.
QPO frequency is what? The orbital frequency is there?
Well, no, it can't be the orbital frequency. The orbital frequency would be much higher. Okay. So one possibility might be, you have to have some, either the time scale associated with the QPO could be associated with a drift time scale to the corona, which is short enough. But then you would have to require some feedback mechanism to keep it going with that frequency time scale. Another possibility is, I think, something which Soji brought up when Didier gave his talk, because Didier also finds QPOs which is of order 1 to 10 hertz, okay? And I asked him whether or not there was a correlation between frequency and disk flux. I don't know if you told me. You said there was a correlation with total flux, but I wasn't sure whether there was a correlation with disk flux, which is what I asked you to check. You're going to check that. And so if that turns out to be true, then it may be that the mechanism, well, at least the phenomenology, is very similar between at least this source and the neutron star sources. And so when Didier gave his talk, Soji suggested that perhaps there was oscillations could be trapped in this transition region. And the frequency of those oscillations over the Kepler frequency, you know, is, well, we don't know. You have to do a calculation, but it's certainly less than one, probably maybe of order a tenth. We don't know. That's something that Soji is exploring right now with his student.
Well, I thought that there was 67 hertz.
I haven't talked about that yet. But as I said, when you see this QPO, there's no evidence of 67 hertz. We've searched. We've looked very hard. It's not there. It's not there. Yeah.
Where are the jets in your car too?
Okay. Okay, I didn't finish the story. Well, I suspect that there's always some outflow. I suspect there's always some outflow. And just sometimes there's more outflow than other times. And the reason that I think that there's always outflow is just because you see radio emission, which is quite variable. I have a plot of that somewhere. And it seems more likely to me that, more natural to me, if there's always a wind and it varies, rather than having a situation where there's no wind and then wind. I mean, it's more natural to always have some wind with a variation of the wind.
Well, I guess what I'm leading up to is, could any of these lower frequency QPOs actually come from the jet? And the clock maybe still would be orbiting over there.
Because the relativistic jet is not in our direction, yeah?
Well, I mean, it's 70 miles around the Pacific, I think.
Yes.
The lot of being is very weak in this cell. Mm-hmm. But just wondering if that's the location getting, sort of change the features and so on, for example.
So I don't think it's any correlation, the direct correlation of X-ray emission with just that, with radio emission.
There's a huge delay in radio
emission. So it's might be that just does not have X-ray at all.
All I can say is that I do know that when one sees these frequent QPOs between 1 to 10 hertz, You see them during phases where the source is radio loud, but also you see them where it's radio quiet. We don't see any radio at all. Doesn't mean that there's no wind.
No, yeah,
but yeah, so.
As it happens in the output, I mean, you've got a different possibility of modulating the frequency at the point.
Yes.
Just from the kinematics of the output, the things sort of processing around between where they are or
right.
changing the speed.
Mm-hmm.
And that can give you sort of focus on the frequency.
But I don't think the characteristics of the QPO are any different when it's radio loud or radio quiet.
No, but then it doesn't have to be, because the radio is
really quite
sure. scary.
Yeah.
The other confusion I have is just maybe one more associated there, but is the disk at this transition radius radiation dominated or is it gas dominated?
Because gas dominated.
It's gas dominated at that transition radius.
Yeah. Optical tint variation is dominated. What did you say again?
Sorry, is the disk radius, is the pressure in the disk at the transition radius, is that mostly radiation pressure or gas pressure?
Gas pressure.
It's still all gas pressure. Yes, so it isn't close enough in to be radiation pressure. Because if that disk were to extend all the way down to the horizon, it would ultimately become radiation pressure. So I'm not quite sure where you think this transition radius is, I guess that's
right.
At what distance? Yes.
Yeah. You had a rough formula, you told me. I don't know, this is... you said it was you said it was something like alpha to the fourth over m dot squared?
Yeah.
Forget, this is squared Eddington, and if you normalize this to 0.01, a 0.1 I think you said, this was like, what, 100 RG? Is that right? Was that what you told me? Is that what you said? I don't remember.
Sorry.
Squared, this whole thing squared.
About m dot square and part 4. It is normalized by Eddington.
Eddington, yeah.
Yeah.
In which way?
So, but one of the interesting...
That is almost certainly gas dominated. Within the alpha. Oh, it depends what alpha is.
Alpha, yeah.
Now, that can be very small. If alpha is 0.1, well, I mean, if alpha is
0.1... This is not scaled to 0.1, or is this just alpha? Or is it scaled to 0.1?
No.
Not scaled to 0.1.
Just alpha.
Okay.
So
that would be very small.
If we adopt alpha equal... I suppose in the case m dot 0.1, it is about 100 RG. Is not correct?
So
with that, that would be 500. So then it would be, I think
it's gas pressure.
Is that gas dominated? Is that
I think it's gas pressure dominated. Yeah.
Yeah, it would still be. Because that is a sort of special radius, apart from the transition radius.
Yeah.
We're just seeing around about the suggestion by Bologna et al. That these dips are due to something we know very well about the radiation pressure instability, everything in your disk. And then, of course, it will give a transition radius. I mean, I'm a little skeptical about.
Yeah, I'm a skeptical also. I mean, I think.
So, if this transition radius is much older, so it is some sort of empty region in time. Or not empty region.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, it's a possibility, but but you don't.
If it were true, you wouldn't have it.
Yeah, you know, the question is, you know, what makes this particular source so special? Then, I mean, why don't we see other radiation pressure that goes in other sources?
So
that's the problem.
They said it's because it's closer to Ithaca.
Well, you can also see other examples when it puts the same flux, but it's stable.
Okay, I am on your side, but the offer for me, this is exceptional because it's a higher attrition rate.
But that can't be true because, just the flux you had before me, it says sometimes it's flux is flatter in any oscillation. It can't just be a parameter.
Yeah, but for other objects, we really don't know so many soft state objects. We know C061, and in C061, there's actually stable gas pressure dominated all the way to the minimum stable object at the observed stand up. So we really don't have.
They could be right. Historically, it's very interesting that if you remember the Novikov and Thorne, this model was designed for C061 and the inner radiation dominated part was supposed to be the subject.
Yeah, I guess another interesting thing after I talked to Soji is that the frequency, is proportional to the Kepler frequency. We think probably, it's probably less. We don't know how much less. And so this would go like m dot cubed if you use this relationship between the transition radius and m dot. Of course, the soft flux component also goes like m dot over transition radius, also goes like m dot cubed. So you expect the relationship where the frequency increases, the soft component increase linearly if the coefficient in front is a constant, but it seems to go in the right direction. Maybe it's just numerology, but it's
so
suggestive.
Yeah, maybe.
It's interesting. It's promising.
Well,
so
it looks like a straight line to me.
We should think about it a little further. That's why we're starting to work on this.
I mean, we have a straight line here.
right. Okay. Maybe I should throw this out also, before we go to 67 hertz, since we're talking about bursts. This is something also that I sort of noticed since I've been here. Maybe shut the light off. So again, this is the same source, and these are on different days. What here is the upper panel, this is the count rate, 2 to 13 kilovolts. Function of time. Each tick mark again is 50 seconds. And the bottom panel corresponds to the hardness ratio, 13 to 60, the energy in 13 to 60 divided by 2 to 13. And so what you see is that during these bursts, okay, the hardness ratio is decreased, and during the minimum, the quiescent phase, the hardness ratio is large. So it's hard here, soft here, hard here, soft there. Okay, now you take a look at another date. This is when the system is not undergoing very rapid, undergoing burst activity. It's some perhaps low-level burst activity, certainly not as a larger excursion as you see on this date. You look, the count rate's not that much different than where the peaks are, and you find that the hardness ratio is small, okay, down here. Suggesting that somehow it can make a transition to a high state very quickly. On another day, it is May 8th. This is in the so-called low state. And the count rate's rather low. This is the same scales. Okay? Count rate's low, and you find the hardness ratio is high, just like it is here. Okay? So it looks like somehow the system can go back and forth between states very quickly. That's a little hard to understand.
But see, that photon, the hardness ratio isn't photon number.
taking the counts in the number of counts in that energy band divided by the counts.
So whatever the energy is in those two bands, we have to multiply by some.
Yeah, but the point is that this is a similar.
Right.
Even in a totally different day when the system is not in undergoing outbursts or undergoing these oscillations, it's kind of steady. The intensity is not changing very much, but it seems kind of remarkable that the system. Well, one interpretation would be that somehow the system can change its state very quickly in a time scale of a few seconds. Okay, this time scale is probably only maybe 10 seconds. So it's not like you have to, the system undergoes the state change, you wait a day, and then so it settles in. It does it really quick.
Yeah.
So. You look at this, that's pretty sharp. Look at this, look at the decline, that's pretty sharp. In terms of the time scale. It's still quick. It's still quick. It's on the order of seconds. For example, if you're thinking about, let's say, a cool disk, this thin, geometrically thin, optically thick disk moving in. And it's not going to happen in a few seconds. Okay, it's not going to. If you think that that's what happens when you make these state changes, I don't think that would happen with this, given this data.
Model, what would be the radial drift time scale for this?
I think the radial drift time for the stuff in the corona is probably a few seconds.
Yeah.
Not in the
thin disk.
Probably order 100 seconds or longer, much longer, because the temperatures are lower.
Yeah.
Right. So the viscosity goes like the sound speed.
Yeah, I think that.
So that really puts some constraints. I think this really should tell us something about what's going on in these systems. So I wonder whether or not you really have this thin, geometrically thin, whether that geometrically thin disk is absent. Maybe it's always there, and it's covered by the corona. You don't see. If you get rid of the corona, maybe you can see it.
100 seconds. You can almost see 100 seconds here.
Yeah. But these things are just. Yeah, we'll look at that.
I'm sorry. Yeah, the tick marks are what?
50 seconds.
50 seconds.
That's slightly less. It's not 100 seconds. Yeah. So I think this observation I think is really food for thought.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I think it probably means it's very tough. I think it's very. It may put this kind of picture where you have just a corona, total corona. There's nothing else in there. Maybe you have a wind. That may be difficult in the context of this observation. It may suggest that there is some kind of cool disk in there. M dot in here doesn't have to be the same as M dot out here, for example.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, M dot, the mass flow rate might be different in this cool disk and in the corona. So one way, for example, which you can make this transition quickly is if you were to blow away the corona, or just you have the wind, always have a wind. But mass is also flowing in from the outside in the corona.
So you're finding that the corona is obscuring the disk?
Maybe. Could be.
So it's incredibly optically thick.
Incredibly optically thick. But I'm just worried. I mean, besides you have to produce the outburst amplitude. I mean, I haven't figured that out yet. But
it could be the dissipation is all occurring in the corona in the hard state. And there ought to be some soft radiation there, but that's easily accommodated, I would think. And then the transition would be suddenly the dissipation decides to happen all inside the
thin disk
rather than the corona.
Yeah.
I'm just making this up, but it's useful.
Because you have to explain this amplitude, there's a huge variation in the outburst.
I mean,
you have to do it that way.
You can also replenish the disk in these intervals in the low
mid. Well, this is reasonable. Oh, okay.
You were asking what's so special about the structure.
I think you already told us. You told us the drift time scale is about 100 seconds.
That's for.
There's ample time in one of those big humps. In a part of that disk.
And it's got a wind that's rotating, a black hole rotating. I don't know, but it's something different than other sources. That's right. That's right. Yes, Soji. Thermal instability? I think you mean a thermal instability in a cool disk?
Yeah.
I think it's really tough to get these quick transitions.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't tried, but I mean, it's possible. It's possible. I haven't tried it though.
Yeah. What do you think, Chuck? I mean, it's obviously not the usual capping instability, but maybe the thermal instability is probably a bit more instability. Okay.
What was the thermal instability?
Well, just when it starts to become radiation dominated, there's a thermal instability for the usual reason.
We know.
Yeah, like that. Doesn't look like that usually.
You think it's the wrong shape.
Well, also, I think if you just use just a radiation pressure dominated one, it's difficult to get to explain why the time during the quiescence is comparable to the time during outburst. Usually for the because
because
Good
point. Yeah, good point.
Gee, that's a very good point. That is true.
That
the outburst time equals the.
Yeah, because if you look at, let's see. Basically, when you have these radiation pressure, this high state's quite high. I mean, this ratio is factor 100 sometimes. And so that leads to very long quiescent times compared to burst times. So in order to do this, you actually have to bring it down so that this ratio is smaller.
There was this very funny correlation source measure. T goes as R to the minus 7.5 or something.
T goes as what? Wait, what's this?
Wasn't that?
What's that?
It goes below E to the time is equal to the fleshman time or the
intensity. Oh, T is time.
Yeah.
Which is sort of funny with this, because in the case of dwarf node, you have to increase the jump. So
here you need to decrease the jump because of this. That's because of that.
It's just the opposite.
Yeah, well, of course, it's just because dwarf nova, of course, is a different kind of instability, different physics. But yeah, that's required.
Yeah, I think it was plus 7.5.
So I think this is a lot very interesting observation.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Ron, is a characteristic of these objects that the outburst time correlates with the preceding quiescent time rather than the following? Well, I'm wondering if that's a pattern that one sees more generally.
No, there's not really established.
This object is really unique.
There are times where it looks like it is, and where the outburst is correlated with the quiescent time before, and there are times when it does not.
Oh, even in this object?
Even in this object. That's right. It's not reliable.
I think there's nothing similar in any other.
No.
One?
Yes.
Do you see an NH variation?
NH variation. You mean the column density variation? Yeah. I think if you let it to do the fitting, there are some indications, but not very significant. I mean, this is very far away, so I mean, you expect, so it's most common density like 10, several times 10 to the 22. Okay, so if you want variations, that means it have significant, blowing out a lot of significant mass in the vicinity of the source, and I don't think they see this evidence of this.
Well, this object does resemble one simple property. The object that Jean Pierre showed in his second talk, you commented on how repeatable the bright magnitude was. I can't remember. That was a dwarf nova, I think. But
yeah, or that's your time.
Why is the outburst luminosity so repeatable?
I don't know. Maybe it has something to do with Eddington luminosity. I don't know.
Yeah.
For example. I don't know. I mean, because also, if you could imagine that. It may also be different in the sense that there is a wind, there's a wind going on, and maybe during certain phases, when it's in outburst, maybe the wind is even more important. I mean, that if you just start throwing away mass, that certainly can change the properties of the outburst. In fact, if you have a wind, that could also affect the stability. I mean, it could even make the radiation pressure instability be stabilized.
So how do we know the distance?
They look at it from the radio. They look at column. You know, they look at, you know, they see it's behind a certain H2 region or something like that. Yeah, I think, yeah, it's 21 centimeters. Yeah.
So what is the mass? It's the highest 37.
Well, he said the luminosity is of order 2 × 10⁻³, roughly about 2 × 10⁻³. If you assume it's isotropic.
Only 2 × 10⁻³.
Yeah. But then there's a lot of energy in the jet.
Make a conservative estimate of the power carried by the jet, like it is 4 feet.
There's 10 to 40 or so.
Power?
Yes.
The
power.
Right.
Power in the jet,
right.
Like it is 4 feet.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, you can make a conservative estimate of that. It's
10 to 40 or something like that.
And it's even more dramatic if you believe the infrared sources that constitute the extended radio lobes.
Yeah, but power in the jet is not as intermittent.
That's right, yes, but in terms of the power of the source.
Yeah, but I mean,
yeah.
So if you say radiation...
2 × 10⁻³, roughly.
Yeah. 39, which is only...
10 solar masses.
Yeah. Because there were some papers going into 30 solar masses. Yeah.
Well, that has to come from this 67 Hertz QPO, which we haven't talked about yet.
You know, that's a model where you're just...
Sorry?
...pushing the disk to the corona and then back to the disk. Would at least possibly tie in with the repeatable high state luminosity. You've got a certain accretion rate and a certain dissipation rate, and you're just, I don't know what his mechanism is. He has one for dissipating it in the corona. If you can do that, at least then if it's all or nothing.
Yeah, but then, yeah, but if you take that picture, then of course you expect there to be a thin disk there always, all the way down.
Right.
So you wouldn't have a total ADAF with it, you know, just optically thin gas.
Do you know insulation?
670 degrees. 70 degrees.
You know that from the radio, assuming that the disk is perpendicular.
This is almost the same as 1655.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
It's
also 70 degrees.
From the
jet. Yeah, see the jet.
From the jet.
Yeah.
Because in 1655, jet gives 85 degrees.
I thought it was
60 or something. Like
so I thought it was 70. Yeah. 70.
So it's not perhaps not so fascinating.
Okay, so let's just there's some discussion about 67 hertz, so we'll show 67 hertz. So this source also shows evidence of high frequency oscillations, and this is from Morgan, Remelot, and Greiner's paper, where they actually discovered a 67 hertz feature right here. And it's seen on there several days, and the luminosity, when I've seen the 67 hertz feature, it's been unchanged in frequency by about 1 or 2 hertz over a luminosity range of a factor of 4.
Never changed, I think it's right.
Yeah, I mean, is it within 1 or 2 hertz? This is, now, you never see this feature when the photon index is around 2.6 or so, when you see the 1 to 10 hertz kilohertz, sorry, 1 to 10 hertz QPOs. You do not see it. You do not see it. The spectrum during this time is characterized by a soft spectrum with a photon index more like 3 and 3.5, where it's really a black body-like. Okay? So here, the spectrum is soft.
Spectrum is soft, but again, that's Homer's question. Are the 67 hertz photons soft or soft?
You can see here, you actually see the RMS is a function of energy for 67 hertz.
So again, they're hard.
They're hard. They're harder. Okay.
Wow.
Okay, they're harder.
But it's truly remarkable that it's never moved.
Never moved.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
The disk is, if I'd have got a mark on the black hole, I couldn't say that. I know what I've done something. What's it going to be made of?
So what is the Keplerian frequency for first?
Well, they originally
67 hertz tells you a density, so it's going to be body disorbiting.
Yeah, originally they interpreted the 67 hertz as a Kepler frequency, and if it did, then it would be 33 solar masses. That was original. I think that's the interpretation.
But what is orbiting,
Sure. Why would
from 1 month to the next? It's still.
Yeah.
What is it?
So it's not obvious to me. It's not obvious to me if you had something going around, whether you can actually produce enough power. I mean, the RMS is of order several percent. I mean, it's tough to produce. I don't know. There's not much energy you can release at that orbit.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to get the modulation.
Yeah, but still, I mean, this is seen in the very soft state.
Yeah. Very soft state.
And in the very soft state, probably the disk is all the way to the new state.
Probably.
Possibly.
Probably.
And then something happens.
Yeah, something happened. The question is what?
The comparison is really soft, but if you pick 20% modulation in the hard component, that's nothing. Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you actually try to fit,
that's not something where
it's actually if you actually fit the spectrum, I had a student look at this, and he was an undergraduate student, so he just kind of fit anything to it. This is why I talked to Paolo about things. But he found that you could fit the spectrum during this state with two black bodies, okay? And with the QPO was associated with a higher temperature black body, about 2 keV. That's what he found. But
2 keV?
Yeah.
So that could be the difference.
Could be. Mm-hmm. That's right. Other interpretations for...
But even so, I mean, identifying with them... stable orbit where you've got this huge
range. Right. I don't think that's appropriate.
Yeah.
I mean, also, there's the same problem with people who try to interpret this in terms of lens theorem precession, because they have to, again, choose a certain radius.
That's a radius,
because lens theorem precession frequency depends on radius.
Yeah.
And so, I have problems with that also. Bob Wagner talks about, maybe I have a picture. The other possibility is some disco seismology that Bob Wagner talked about, and actually Soji Kato's worked on, I've worked on. And so this is the epicyclic frequency is a function of radius, and this is what it is for without GR. So this is just a Keplerian frequency, and you put GR in, you have a pseudo Newtonian potential, then there's a possibility that you could have modes trapped with frequencies less than epicyclic frequency. I think for G modes, the problem is it's really tough to produce the amplitude of an order of percent. And
based on ideas of turbulence.
Yes.
Which nobody understands.
Imagine how we could nail that. If one could look at the first two trap modes.
If you actually saw more than one frecuency,
then
that would really help.
Yeah.
But you only have one frequency, so that's a problem.
So we can imagine nailing that in the future.
I mean, if there were higher frequency, maybe could be higher frequency oscillations. You just can't see it because the statistics aren't good enough.
Yeah.
So it's maybe with a higher larger area, high timing experiment, if you could actually see more than one frequency, that would presumably nail it for you.
Even if we perhaps consider higher harmonics, the frequency difference would be very small. Yeah. Here, then fundamental mode, then
Yeah.
Castle Overton is the direct US. I can't remember that. Right? And so it began, that equivalent is very narrow. So even if many kinds of modes are excited, the
representation
will not be.
You're saying that the first time we're going to be tied inside the same frequency?
Except no.
Okay, I'm not understanding. What's your point?
For example, that is the corrupted fundamental mode. Then we consider this is a, yeah, if we consider higher harmonics in which the, there is one node.
Yeah.
In the, the radial direction, then frequency changes, but the frequency is almost around here.
These are actually symmetric modes.
Yes, actually symmetric, yes.
So it doesn't match.
So frequency is harder.
Yeah, the frequencies are only the same as you change the number of nodes. But, I mean, this must be happening fairly close to the horizon, and any non-axisymmetry in the mode would be subject to, you know, the stuff would be swinging around and would be subject to Doppler boosting, which is a quite big amplifier at the radii for any reasonable black hole mass. And so it would seem that given a sort of usual slew of modes, symmetric, axisymmetric and non-axisymmetric, the ones that you would see might be the non-axisymmetric simply because they've got sort of stuff swinging around. What, you know, it's not quite clear what's moving, whether it's, you know.
Right.
Because there's not, you know, you would get the one. One for sphere received at the sweep is alpha and so on. You know, that's a big factor in the model speed.
So anyway, that's one type of oscillation. The other type, these are G modes. The other types, which are related to lens steering precession, are these so-called corrugation modes, these C modes, which reflect the motions vertically as well, coupling vertically and horizontally. And these are related to these lens steering precession. And these frequencies in this direction, vertical direction, are different from the frequencies in the radial direction when the hole is rotating.
Yeah, right.
So that's when you would get that. But I don't know if anybody's actually looked at that yet in terms of constructing eigenfunctions for that. And I don't think so. And the other possibility are P modes, where you actually have inertial acoustic modes, and those are the modes that I've studied.
What do you for you to say those words? Next to what about them?
And they seen the frequencies that one obtains for those. So I guess I have a plot. So here's a calculation that was done, actually a two-dimensional calculation, axisymmetric calculation. So we have a matter accreting about accretion rate around 2/10 of Eddington. Energy transport by radiation is included. So it's a radiation hydrodynamic calculation, and assumes that viscosity is. The usual viscosity is alpha viscosity. So this is the luminosity is a function of time. This is only a few seconds. And this is blow up on a short time scale. And if you take a power spectrum, you find that the frequency is of order 100 hertz. And by looking at the flows, I don't have them with me. Looking at the flows, you can actually see matter moving. Radially, I mean, in certain cases you do see some sort of motion in the vertical direction, but those I'm not sure those are really G modes. These modes structures of the disks here are convective. I've tried to suppress convection by considering cases where the viscosity is not the constant, nu is a constant, kinematic viscosity is constant, to try to suppress that effect, which I did partially successfully. And in that case, these oscillations are still present. Here, the oscillations are driven by like an epsilon mechanism for stars. So it's not like convection. It's just you squeeze it, you get more energy generation, expands.
Sorry, what was the whole mass here?
The whole mass was 10. Okay, and so here, which you see, when you look at a given radius, you can look at the frequency that's oscillating, and it seems that for a radii between 3 to about 6 Schwarzschild radii, they're all oscillating at the same frequency. And as you go to larger radii, then you see it's no longer global. You actually start seeing the local local epicyclic frequency at those larger radii.
Is it spinning ball?
No, not spinning. That's something that one could do, but haven't done that.
Is there reason to believe that the frequency would remain fixed even if the other conditions change?
If I change the accretion rate, mm-hmm. it wouldn't change much, because the temperatures down here don't change very much, because it's very cooling dominated, because the gas stars in this region roughly around 5-6 RG, and the temperature is starting to decrease,
right,
as you go closer to the hole, because the effectiveness of evection. So probably not, because if it's a pressure wave, it's affected by sound speed, but sound speed doesn't change that much with accretion rate at those regions. So one would not expect the frequency of this type of mode to change with accretion rate. I should mention that there are two other sources for which high frequency oscillations have been seen, 1655 minus 40, which has a mass of estimated around 6 solar masses from optical. And that has a 300 hertz high frequency QPO. And another source, 1550, has a frequency of 185 hertz, but that one changes by about 10%. So that does not fit into this category. So I don't know what's going on there. I'm not sure I know what's going on here. I mean, this is a possibility. And the fact that it seems to be present over a range of radii from 4 to 3 to 2.5 to 6 Schwarzschild radii at least gives you a significant area over which you can have modulation, so that you can get order of a percent or so luminosity modulation, whereas it's much more difficult at the G mode. At least no one's done the nonlinear calculation, so it's not sure, but at least in linear calculation is very tough to make that, to produce that. I should also say that I don't know how much I believe this, but the widths of these QPOs are also important, and the Q values, which Q is defined as the ratio of the frequency divided by the full width half max, and for these high frequency QPOs for this source 1915, they're about 10 to 20, and it's not too bad, but that's another important aspect that has to be is an important observational piece of information that's useful. So I think the jury's still out about what these things are. I mean, there are possibilities, but until one actually knows a little bit more about the source, for example, if there are other higher frequency modes, that would help to nail it. But just one frequency is not enough. If we knew the mass, that would say whether or not this class of models is correct, but still you wouldn't be able to distinguish and identify which particular model would be the applicable one. Okay, while we're talking about 67 hertz, the 67 hertz feature is also seen with other QPOs, not seen with the 1 to 10 hertz that we just saw. It's seen with the lower frequency, even lower frequency. Actually, 67 millihertz QPOs are seen when 67 hertz features are seen. Okay. And this suggests, of course, I mean, this is a factor of 1,000 in frequency, and suggests or implies that the mechanism responsible for the production of these two different QPOs is probably different. It's not likely that they're due to the same mechanism. So you have two things going on. And I have a plot. Yeah, Roger?
Well, I just hadn't heard about the six, the eight. Hadn't heard about the 16-second period.
There are.
Okay, they come with the 67.
Yes. Not all the time, but you do. But most of the time, whenever you see 67 hertz, you see a very low frequency component.
Okay, low, is it low. Just low frequency noise, or is it discrete?
It's discrete. You actually could see it. You can actually see it in the light curve. You don't have to even use the FFT to find it. You can actually see it directly. And in fact,
how many data that shows that?
Actually, it's in that paper by Remillard.
Okay.
I don't have it.
Could this be a beat between two GMOs? Are the GMOs that close in space?
Well, I don't know what produces I don't think so.
Well, I don't know either. But we're talking about two GMOs.
Let me just say something else. Okay. There is a correlation of the 67 millihertz feature with the 67 hertz feature. And that's shown here. Let me explain this. Let's see if I remember. Okay, so what I'm plotting is the phase, the average phase of the 67 millihertz QPO, okay? So here's the minimum of the 67 millihertz feature down here, and this is near the maximum, okay? And what you see is that in the bottom here panel corresponds to the RMS amplitude of the 67 hertz QPO, okay? So basically this is the upper limit. So what it suggests is that during the minimum, so you have this light curve for the 67 millihertz, during the minimum intensity for the 67 millihertz feature, the 67 hertz RMS is down. We can't detect it. It could be there, but it's down. During the phase when the 67 millihertz feature is near max, then you start seeing it. You see the 67 hertz feature. Okay, you can detect it. So this is folded over many 67 millihertz QPO phase to bring up statistics. So what this says is that during this modulation on 16 seconds, during the minimum of this modulation, the 67 hertz feature tends to go away, and during the maximum of the 67 hertz millihertz feature, the 67 hertz intensity is strong. So what that tells me is that 16 seconds is quite long, so it suggests that that's some, maybe it's a diffusion time, so some kind of instability, thermal instability, some kind of instability on the outside is propagating in on that time scale. And as that propagates in, when the intensity for the 67 hertz is strong, that means that mass flow has gotten down to the inner regions, and then you've got a larger amplitude variation. If the 67 hertz is produced in the inside, very close to the black hole at near 3 or 5 Schwarzschild radii, then you expect the intensity of the 67 hertz, the RMS of 67 hertz increase. And when you get to when this wave passes by and you have a minimum intensity in the 67 millihertz, that means there's less mass flow flowing in that inner region, then the intensity of the 67 hertz feature drops. So I think what this is very suggesting is that the 67 millihertz feature is produced on the outside, and the 67 hertz feature is produced on the inside. So some observational evidence here for that. But we don't, I haven't identified, what this 67 millihertz is. I mean, that's, you see it in the light curve. It's, as I said, you can see it directly in the light curve. It's pretty strong if you can see it directly in the light curve. And, again, maybe some kind of S curve, who knows? Okay, it's right. The time scale is right for some sort of S curve, but what kind of S curve? I don't know.
Is it getting softer? Is it getting harder?
I can't tell you whether it's how the spectrum is changing. All I know during this phase, it's still soft.
What are those
error bars?
How many sigma?
I think that's one sigma actually.
Okay.
Well, sorry, one thing, but then I can almost, be lying to that.
Yeah.
But these are upper limits. Yeah. Upper limits.
So this is, I'm supposed to think of this as the top of a one sigma error bar here?
Well, we didn't detect it. At this level. We couldn't detect anything below 0.7%. So it could be down here. We just don't detect it.
So if you're sure it's not there.
We're sure it's not there.
Yeah.
But we certainly detected these other places.
Yeah.
Okay.
It could be like suggested the beach frequency between whatever produces and the orbit.
The amplitude is pretty large. And light, I mean, amplitude of 6 to 10 millimeters is pretty large because you can see the light curve.
It's more like the dog than the tail.
Yeah. That's right. So I would, that's the reason for not, yeah, it'd be hard to believe that interpretation, but. Yeah.
If you take the 67 millimeters, how is that relative to the 20 or 40 minutes period that are reported for the outbursts? Does it appear in, when you see those periods or not?
Okay, let me see. I mean, you're talking about these kind of things here? These are the 20 minutes, these kind of things?
There's a 20 minute period and there's a 40 minute period that are recorded. 40 minutes for the radio.
Well, here for example is like 25 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay.
What part of that side would you see the 67 millimeter?
Well, the spectrum is supposed to be rather soft. I'd have to see. I have to know what the spectrum is. I know this is hard spectrum here, soft spectrum here, but I don't recall, whether you actually see them, those 67 millihertz features in here. As far as I know, on this day, on the days where you see this kind of feature, we've looked for 67 hertz. And haven't seen it, and usually they're associated with 67 millihertz, so I haven't seen it at all. And probably part of the problem is that things are changing too fast. I mean, you actually look at things where things are not changing very much. So we haven't seen that. So there's a lot to think about, a lot of questions, no answers, or very few answers. So
you think the remarkable stability of the 67 hertz frequency is not a possible model of that.
That's correct. That's correct.
It's viable.
It's viable. Yeah. But that would imply if it were 67, if the 67 hertz feature were due to inertial custom mode, at least of this type, then that was for a Schwarzschild black hole.
Yeah,
tensile mass. But if it's spinning, then the frequencies will be different. Will change.
Sure.
So we'll have to when that. Yeah. So going back to this other picture, when you were talking about what you can actually see the QPOs here, the 67 hertz. So actually, this is looking into different phases. Remember, you said, okay, so you can't see anything here. So this is actual the power density spectra, this feature frequency. So you're looking for something at 67 hertz. So this is the phase during the minimum of the 67 millihertz. So you don't see anything. And here's 0.1 to 0.2, something starts coming up. So I could say you could detect it there.
Okay, I see. Somehow this is more convincing.
And then you can't see it here.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So it's a straight line across. Looks like there's something there. I think the other thing that we're starting to do is to try to look at phase lags. And that's to say, you're looking at in the QPOs where the hard components are coming in at a later time than the softer components, or vice versa. And for 67 hertz feature, we've found delays, hard delays, corresponding to a time scale of, I think it was 3 milliseconds. So it suggests, so the hard photons come out 3 milliseconds a little later than the soft photons. So that could imply, one possibility is it by scattering over a region of water, perhaps 10 to the 8 centimeters or so, which is pretty big. You know, if you have one of corona that large, but maybe not. If the optical depth is just one.
Well, but if we turn down the temperature, turn up the optical depth.
Yeah, as possible. So I think so. Another diagnostic that one can use to probe, let's say, perhaps maybe the size of the corona in these systems, are these phase lags. Although,
it's not large. I mean, for 30 solar masses,
it's just. Yeah, for not 30 solar masses. Yeah, for 30 solar masses, not large, right? But I think one has to be a little careful for with the phase lags. However, since there are different contributions of phase lags, if, for example, the photons can be emitted, if the photons are emitted at the same time, then it's just scattering will do the phase lag. But if photons are emitted at slightly different times, as the matter is diffusing, so there is a slight complication. But probably for 67 hertz, you're not, if everything's happening in the innermost region, it's not likely that the latter is taking place at the former. So maybe it does give you some idea of what the size of the coronal region or the scattering region is.
Yeah, the subtotal signal
that's
long is 1.5 milliseconds.
So this is with the 0.04 hertz feature, or what is it?
No, it's just...
This is just a continuum.
Continuum.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's much shorter than the half-wave.
Much shorter?
Much shorter than the half-wave.
When it have a larger... Yeah,
when
larger?
You know, up to 1 second.
1 second, let's see. Yeah, so what is that? Do you think the warp disk is warped or something? That you have... Scattering
that
hard state, yeah.
Oh, I don't know.
You don't know. Yeah. 1 second is long. Yeah. 1 second is long.
Yeah,
that's a very large corona.
Yeah, but I mean, it is more complicated, and the soft state is also simpler. The time lags out is shortened, but compatible with sort of 20, 30 short shot radial region where you expect most of the dissipation. So
yeah. Right.
I think the compensation is quite viable.
Yes. That's right. Yeah. Paolo, you want to say something?
So if you do, instead of these phase lags are in Fourier space, so if you do it in the time domain, you just do your ordinary cross correlation function. This is for hard to signal 6-1, 3 kV versus different energy bands. And draw the
equal.
Yep. Yeah.
So
this is a standard cross correlation function. And in principle, if you've got a corona of a certain size and uniform density, you'll pick up the size of the corona should show up in the phase, in this lag too. And the danger with phase lags, like you get a 1 second phase lag in the hard state, okay, so you can produce that lots of different
ways. Yeah.
And when you look at it this way, there's no lag at all, down to about 3 milliseconds. Everything's peaked in the hard state. So with this extended corona, you know, this Tatarchuk one, you can sort of do it, but this tells you very tight constraints on how much optical depth you guys get to a very dense core, and then in principle you can get extended.
So there were previous times of lags, but they were based on...
No, they're right. Those phase lags are there.
They are, though.
But now you do it in the time domain. Just plot the good old cross-correlation function, don't Fourier transform it.
Cross-correlation of what?
The light curve at 1 energy, 3 kV, versus the light curve at...
Yeah, this is a correlation
function.
No, the phase lags were plotted as a function of the Fourier period. So for very long Fourier period, the time lags were very long.
Very long.
And here you have no phase, you have just cross correlation.
Just cross correlation.
So it's different. So there are real phase lags. If you take 1 second Fourier period, you get composite phase lags.
The Tarjiks, those guys, Tarjiks, you have this big corona, so the long Fourier whatever period probe large scale, and so that's how you scatter.
But it's not
one
star, it's one.
Yeah. So your point is?
The point is that most of your stuff has to be happening in a very small region. You can try lots of different models, even their extended corona model. They have
already. So what's dominating the photon?
What's dominating the photon?
The radiation
and short time scale. So even in the hard state, I would claim that your shocks are happening. most of them are happening in a smaller region, compatible with like a few milliseconds of crossing time. And then you can go, so this rules out, I think, a lot of the extended coronal, or it tells you that most of the scattering has to happen in a smaller region of a few milliseconds.
Mm-hmm.
That is real?
No, because those guys can have an adjustable parameter where they can adjust the ratio of density in the dense component and in the extended corona. So if you just put enough density in the
central region. So density stratification within the corona, that's essentially what.
Yeah, right. And like 80% of it or 90, some fraction has to be sitting in the dense little core. So the thing almost looks like your ordinary compensation current. But then there's another problem. You can use the autocorrelation function, and it doesn't mean anything. But this is at the 3 kV, and then this is decreasing. As you go down, that's increasing energy. So this is 3 kV versus 3 kV. This is 30 kV versus 30 kV. And what you see is that the autocorrelation function gets narrower as a function of energy. So in the usual way, that means the spikes, the shots, whatever, tend to get narrower as a function of energy. Now you take a compensation model, so we did the same calculation, you shoot photons through it. The high energies always take more scattering, they come later.
Yes.
So but the autocorrelation gets longer in the standard target, whatever, extended corona here. So it doesn't explain the right.
Okay, but that's assuming delta function shots. What if you did a sort of Fabian or Pitonin
type? That's a completely different.
No, it's
yeah, then you can do
you
this.
You can do whatever you like.
You can do whatever you like. You have to, right.
Could you identify these models by the orbit?
Yes, in the real
one. Because there's at least two to charge it.
Right. In the real person, this is Kazanis and Kazanis is really the person.
Yeah, but these are all names. Can you actually say what the models are?
The model is you've got a dense core like a. So you've got a thin disk like here, and then you put a corona, a central spherical corona at the center, very high density.
Yes.
And then you put an extended corona where the density goes as r to the n of r goes as r to the minus 1.
Yes.
So all the mass is sitting at large radius.
All the opposite vectors logarithmic.
Right. Yeah.
So who is this one?
Kazanis, Swan,
and Tatarchuk. Okay.
And the reason they did it on here.
Does it fit the
it, but it does, if you do, you can keep the Fourier spectrum from this because you have this r to the minus 1 fall off and you look where the photons scatter, you will indeed get this f to the minus 1 power spectrum behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And you also get long phase length. So, and it's pretty robust. The only thing is that it's very sensitive.
But you don't get
this. You don't get this.
You won't get this because this should have a larger width. The correlation, the higher
the
energy.
The function energy, yeah.
Fine.
Yeah. So that shows the danger if you look at one thing, like if you throw away the phase information, like focus on the power spectrum. There are lots of different things that give you an f to the minus 1 power spectrum.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It really is. What actually causes these flares?
You tell me.
Is it that you're injecting power into the corona, or is it that
I don't
you're
know. So that relates back to
a static corona. And if it's that you're injecting power into the electrons, then you could easily. I mean that
then you could easily do this, and that's sort of what Poutine and Fabian were doing.
Right.
Well, you inject power because you in the hard state you see that the total luminosity goes up and down by factor of the pure.
So you must inject power. So
this is just. Yeah, so in this model.
It depends on how you inject.
Right. Yeah, the other thing in this, because I'm trying to check the model, you just inject soft photons and let them scatter up. There are hundreds of other things you could change to.
Okay. Delta function injection is all power spectrum comes from scattering.
But wait, just from scattering. A dumb question. If you do inject more soft photons, you do get more hard X-ray velocity, right? Just because you're cooling the corona. Right?
Well, but
yeah,
you have constant input
of
the
photon.
You know, the amplification is, say, 15. So if you change soft photon by factor of 2, you really, you know, if you have the same power in electrons, you have to change.
This is another This is thermal compensation or non-thermal?
In the half state, it's thermal compensation.
Thermal compensation.
This is thermal compensation.
Yeah.
And, but is, again, you don't have. There's no indication of any variation in the temperature of the corona.
In the hot state?
Yeah. Well,
there is.
Yeah.
Oh, there is.
Yeah.
Velocity?
Yeah.
Tell us more.
Not in these millisecond times, because we can't.
No times. But in general, the lower the spectrum, the higher the temperature.
Huh?
Yeah, so there's an overall correlation.
And then the other statistics you do.
I think these issues deserve a whole other step up.
Yeah.
That's fine with me. I probably have discussed what I wanted to discuss. And there's a lot more I can talk about, but I think. Okay. So I mean, there are other things I could talk about, but it would just be too much to sort of different, more like another seminar rather than continuation of this one.
Okay, maybe sometime in the next 2 weeks.
Yeah.